You're listening to World Building for Masochists.
And we're wondering why we do this to ourselves.
I really just wanted someplace to do mad science. I'm Premi Mohammed.
I'm Cass Morris.
I'm Marcia Ryan Maresca.
I'm Natanya Barron. And this is episode 126, When World Building Gets Wild.
It really varies how much of this conversation I keep in the podcast.
Just for flavor.
Well, sometimes it is like just a good like transition from like whatever like the guest said as their world building quip, and sometimes so you don't want to lose that because it's some good stuff. And sometimes we don't have like a clean break between that and our actual like hello friends, thanks for joining us again. Bit. And so, with no clean break, we just, you know,
we just have to
roll.
And that's why editing is amazing.
It is.
It is.
So take us away, Mr. Maresca.
So welcome back, friends, to another glorious episode of World Building for Masochists, where we have another amazing guest. Premi, will you please tell us all about you and how amazing you are?
I can tell you a little bit about me. I am a writer and scientist based out of Edmonton, Alberta, where spring has not really sprung, and there is a super obnoxious, perfect rectangle of snow still left in my yard, which I go out every day and yell at, because that's so helpful. I'm the author
Why is it a perfect rectangle?
Because that's where the garage next door shades it, just like, apparently to such a degree that by the time the sun swings around, it can't melt it. I'm just irritated by how perfect the rectangle is. And now I forgot about the other things I was going to say. But anyways, I read
Sorry.
Books.
Sorry, tell us about
stories.
Books.
No, that's okay.
And mysterious
rectangles. I write books. I write books that are also rectangle-shaped. I write stories that are occasionally shaped like a rectangle. My most recent releases were in February, The Butcher of the Forest came out from Tor.com. That's a novella. And just this week, actually, The Siege of Burning Grass, a novel, came out from Solaris Books. So I am having a busy 2024 so far.
Correct me if I'm wrong, do you have another one coming out soon as well? Or am I
have one coming out in June, and then I have two more after that for the year. So five books total.
Just a few. Wow, that's quite a year. I would be a basket case.
I've been a basket case since like last fall when I realized that this was happening. You know, it's one of those things where like you get the email and you're like, oh, okay, they sent me, you know, the launch date. Thanks, I'll make a note of that. And then you get another email and you're sitting there like, wait a minute.
And then you look at your calendar for the year and go, oh, wait. That's when those days are.
Die.
I do love your graphic approach, though. You were just like, there's a lot. So here's one handy graphic. So you can follow along.
Yeah. I should fill that in as I get more covers. I think one of those has a cover now. But yeah, I write books.
So what do you feel like? I mean, aside from having beautiful covers, because you seem to have books that just hit it out of the ballpark every time. I think your covers are gorgeous.
I've been very lucky.
Yes. And I super cool. But you are known for some things besides that. Talk a little bit about maybe what do people know you for? Aside from the writing as well. You have a very unique presence, I feel like, on social media for the things that you're passionate about.
Gosh, I don't know. I hope I'm known for someone being relatively friendly and approachable on social media and also having just like real impulse control problems. I have no filter. I cannot shut up. I have tried. And the people in my life, I think, are extremely glad that finally social media became something that I started using, because I was just like this to them at all times prior to social media being an outlet. So I'm glad that's over. Maybe I am also known for bouncing around in genres. I know I occasionally get confused emails from people who are catching up on my backlist and being like, hey, fill in the blank here, wasn't cosmic horror? I'm like, yeah, I write lots of stuff. I don't know. I write fantasy, I write sci-fi, I write horror, I write alternate history. Sometimes they all happen in the same book. I feel like that's a marketing problem, not a me problem.
You contain multitudes, and it's their issue.
I do contain multitudes. Yes.
And how does that, so in terms of world building, I mean, I'm sure that poses some challenges, but how do you approach world building? What do you love about it?
Oh, gosh. Oh, my God. So this is why I was so excited to be invited to this podcast, which, by the way, thank you. I can talk about world building all day and all night, but world building is really what first drew me to reading sci-fi and fantasy. It was this idea that, oh, you can just make up a world that is very, very different from our world, and there's no limit to it. It can be as different as you want. There's no world building police. They're not going to pull you aside and be like, excuse me, H.G. Wells, but I don't think that's what things are going to look like in 100,000 years on planet Earth. As far as I know, he was never, you know, pulled aside for that or ticketed or anything like that. You know, the way you can just immerse yourself into a story with world building because it is so different from your everyday life that you've kind of, you know, you've gotten so used to everything's turned into wallpaper, but now here's a world where maybe, you know, magic is real, or you know, people can upload their consciousness to a computer and it's not like a stupid idea. And you know, things like that. So falling in love with other people doing it really well, I think just fed into my own desire to write specifically in genres where I could build my own world and just, you know, control those variables of it that I thought were most interesting or most worthwhile for the story, or that, you know, limit or constrain or curse my characters the most, because that's really important in fiction, is that your characters are just suffering really horribly. And, and you know, that's what world building is to me. It's an intrinsic part of a speculative narrative that should form part of the plot and can't be swapped out with something else without affecting the story.
I love that. It's one of the things I talk about when I've done, like, you know, workshops and things about world building, is like, how can your world create problems for your characters? Like, what obstacles can your world throw in their way that perhaps a reader doesn't expect because it's not the obstacles we encounter, but how can the world make your characters' lives more difficult?
Exactly.
I also really love saying that there is no world building police, because there's not.
But there's people who think they are.
I was going to say, and we should encourage people that they're not only are they not, but do not self-appoint yourself as the world building police. It's not your job.
No. Gosh. Yeah. And I think that, like, my approach to it too is probably something that if there were world building police, they'd at least, you know, give me a warning. Because I just, you know, I'm not one of those people who, like, world builds first and then sets the story in the world. I just world builds as I go along. And if there's something that's just totally banana crackers, I write it and then I go back later and in edits, I justify it or I take it out. Most of the time, though, I just write in a reason for it to be there, or I justify it by connecting it to some part of the narrative, or, you know, I give a character a phobia of it or something like that. I don't take it out if it's something that I wanted to be in there and struck me as a kind of cool random thing. I just write and then I go back and build.
And I think that's something that sometimes we miss out on a little bit, is that sometimes it is just the cool factor. Like as much as we want world building to be perfectly sound and to hold up and all this stuff, but sometimes you just do it because it's friggin' cool. Sometimes the monster just has 17 eyes and you don't really have a reason other than 17 eyes just felt like the right choice to make. And I think that may be where we're talking about world building police, where they want this complete suspension of disbelief to the point that it's no longer fiction almost, right? Like this needs to be real. It's like, no. I made this up and I'm unstable sometimes. Like, this is just because I'm having fun, not necessarily that this is like has to be watertight.
I'm sorry, I need a full paper on the economic policy of your world.
Yeah.
Like, no.
And please. That works for some people and some people enjoy that sort of thing, but it's definitely not a requirement, I think is what I'm saying.
I think about it sometimes when it comes to science fiction, especially because I feel like a place where it gets, people like to get really nitpicky is about the physics of like space travel and faster than light technology. And that can be fun. Like, there are books that get nitpicky about it in a wonderful way. But sometimes you can also just be like, I don't know, it works because it works. Maybe physics works differently in that galaxy. We don't know. They've got different rules in that universe. It's fine. It's whatever. It doesn't have to make sense by our rules of physics, because you know what? There are a lot of things I'm willing to teach myself when it comes to world building. I am never going to learn enough about physics to make faster than light travel make sense in anything I write. I'm never going to learn that much physics. It's always going to have to be. I don't know. That's how it works over there.
How does the hyperdrive work? It works well. That's how it works until it breaks down.
Poorly when you don't do the thing right.
Right.
Poorly when you run out of fuel, obviously.
So what are some things that in the real world inspire your world building that you find is a good place when you're, I don't know, if you're ever stuck? I'm not often stuck, but sometimes I am, or things tend to influence me one way or another. But what's gets your world building gears going?
Oh, geez. Yeah, I usually don't need to get the gears going. The gears are usually like way ahead of whatever it is I'm doing. But definitely biology, definitely chemistry. It's not always the case that if I'm looking to create something interesting in a world, that I turn to, well, you know, I'll just make it a living thing. I'll just make it sentient. But there's a lot of that. And also things that I think, you know, would just be visually interesting. If they're not given a purpose, they're kind of, you know, it seems a little surreal. Like in my Void trilogy, in the third book, there's a scene where the characters are up on, you know, a tower in a castle. You know, they need to make their way down. And they're looking across the landscape and there's a ginormous wall there. The wall is so huge that it kind of breaks everybody's brains. And they're like, you know what? I'm going to look at the floor now. I'm actually going to look at the floor. I'm getting a headache and I think I'm losing all my sanity points. There's no reason for that wall to be there. I just wanted to describe it, and I thought it would look cool. And again, of course, in cosmic horror, anything that you look at that makes you feel a little bit insane is actually a good thing. It's literally just, I thought something would be interesting. And then in some cases, it's a case, like for the Siege of Burning Grass, it's a case where I looked at something that maybe had been done in history or had come up in history, or maybe there was a gap that I saw and I was like, oh, why wouldn't they do this? Well, I'm gonna solve that problem in my world, or something like that. Yeah, I guess I'm never really stuck for ideas, let's put it that way.
Same.
I was gonna say, ideas are never the problem.
Time
and focus and...
Yeah. and wondering if your editor will yell at you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or if it makes sense to, you have one of those moments where like, well, it makes sense to me, but that's not the most heartening.
I have those moments. Yeah.
See, I've had the moments where it's like, I'm pretty sure this doesn't make sense. Maybe my editor won't notice. They do. They always notice. It's like, and then you get the note and it's like, yeah, I was really hoping you weren't going to call me out on that. But you did. And my book's going to be better for it. God damn it. Just, fine. I'll fix the thing I knew I should have fixed to begin with.
So it's a good segue into talking about biology, being a scientist, which is super friggin' cool. So you're immersed in this world, presumably, as both professionally and in sub also professionally, right? Because like many of us, we have multiple jobs. Like, not like you're not, you know, going from one job to another. How, having these sort of dual places, how did you kind of come to that? Like, was it just always a plan to kind of write fiction and research, or did it just sort of happen?
Oh boy. So there's kind of a story behind that. Yay. Now. So the plan always was, when I was growing up, to be a scientist. The initial plan, which got scotched very, very quickly, was actually to be an astronaut. But it turns out you have to be able to see. They're really quite sticklers about that. You cannot be up there in the ISS fumbling with your contact lenses. And you have to be somewhat mentally stable too, which I did not know. That should have been a given.
Deeply unfair.
Deeply unfair. I was like, okay, fine. I will just do science stuff here on Earth.
On the ground.
With gravity. Yeah. But it was always the plan. It was very, very early on the plan. Like when I was like 8, my parents gave in to my endless whining and bought me one of those little microscopes, you know, and like the preset thing of slides. And I announced to everybody I was going to be a scientist when I grew up. I wanted to be a microbiologist or an epidemiologist. And they were like, aren't you like 7? Why do you know the word epidemiologist? I'm like, why don't you know the word epidemiologist? So... yeah, and again, you'll have to picture, like, the hair flip and whatever. So my first degree ended up being in molecular genetics, and then I realized, to my extreme surprise, that you do need a particular type of personality to be able to spend the rest of your life in a lab, and I did not have it. Many of the people I graduated with did, and were perfectly happy as genetically modified clams. I did not, and I went back to school to do environmental science. And it turned out I was much, much happier doing field work until my body cacked out on me. And then I ended up doing environmental policy for about 9 years. And then last year, unfortunately, for various health reasons, I burnt out and quit my science job. So now I can't even say I don't think that I'm a scientist anymore. Although, again, the science police have not come and, like, repossessed my degrees.
No, you are still a scientist.
Oh, absolutely.
You might not be
I am
working.
Not a scientist anymore. But my feelings are deeply hurt by that, too, because, like, after I quit, I was, like, you know, I was just absolutely... in a haze for like 6 weeks of just like grief and exhaustion and like just a nervous wreck. And my friends kept pulling me aside to be like, can you stop saying you're unemployed? You're not unemployed. You are a full-time author now. I'm like, I'm unemployed. I'm going to starve to death. I did not starve to death, but I was unemployed. This year I am employed again. I work at the public library as the writer in residence. Which is very cool.
How fun.
But next year I won't have a job again, so the plan is to go back to science. But anyways, the original plan was always to have a career in science, which I did for, you know, slightly over 20 years, and write as a hobby. Sort of the same as, like, cross-stitch or whatever, you know. I would just finish my little projects and then, like, put them away or maybe hang them up in my house somewhere. And I don't know, at some point I started writing and submitting short stories for pocket money because, you know, it's not a ton of money, but a sale, you know, once a month or twice a month is like grocery money. Mm-hmm. It's not nothing. And if you get pro rates, that could be quite a bit. So I was just doing that for fun. And then the problem, again, when you make friends with writers is eventually they kind of start going like this and they're like, you know, the real money's in novels. Mm-hmm. I know you've got a novel somewhere. I'm like... Get behind me.
Little did they know.
So they, yeah, so they get behind you and then they keep saying the same thing, which, whatever. So then I got into long form fiction and my debut novel came out in 2020. And I guess the intersection still kind of between science, a lifetime of science really, and a lifetime of fiction is that they are constantly feeding off one another. And there was never a point where I thought being a scientist was, you know, negatively affecting my writing, except, you know, in terms of time and energy, but like, or being an author was negatively affecting my work as a researcher or as a policy expert or as a person who occasionally fell into holes, which turned out to be an important part of field work. Anyways, you know, it's the ability to research and to know where to go to get reliable sources and how to vet things and how to examine people's motivations in writing things. You know, is somebody being paid to do this research? Who's paying them? Is somebody suppressing some results? How many test subjects did they have? Is there a reason they had so few test subjects? You know, what research is this feeding off of? What's novel about it? What does it connect to? What does it invalidate from older things? And these are all questions we ask when we're looking at literature as well. You know, who wrote this? Why did they write it? What message were they trying to communicate? What's new about it? What's old about it? Where does it touch other books? So it's just a constant feedback loop of what you're taking in and processing and turning into either, you know, scientific literature or speculative literature.
I think that's all hugely important. And it was something that when I was teaching at a community college, I would try to impart to my students, which is that, like, the divide between the sciences and the arts and humanities need not be this giant gulf that people seem to want it to be. You need a lot of the same skill sets when it comes to critical thinking, especially. And if you're a scientist, you need to be able to communicate what you're sciencing about. And it's just not, there's not as big a divide as, I don't know, I think, like, people who run universities want there to be, I guess.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, we got to convince you absolutely. That you got to pick a lane. And it's like,
yeah.
I mean, I'm super bad at that.
And they want to
like
divide
science.
The lanes with, like, concrete barriers.
Yeah.
They don't want you to be able to, like, move lanes easily. And yeah. I've always found that just so bizarre. They're like, don't get your English major in my science. That's disgusting. It's like you've just told them you're going to spit in the punch bowl.
You're doing STEM. You do not need to learn any humanities whatsoever. No, no.
One of my favorite compliments from a teacher ever was, I loved biology, but I was the art kid. I mean, I was art, music, English, right? But I loved biology. And I remember we were dissecting animals and she said, you're one of the most talented dissectors I've ever had. That was like, it's the hand, the art kids, paintbrushes and stuff,
true,
you know?
You can keep it steady.
You can keep it steady. And for me, it was very artistic to take this, you know, creature who had presumably given their lives, in, you know, for science, you know. But it was like, I thought it was also beautiful. There's something aesthetically beautiful and macabre, I think, as well, about dissection, though, in a way that I think most people just get the ick about. But I think more art kids in science would be wonderful, because science is so beautiful, especially now as we're in this age of data. You need people that understand aesthetics to make the data make more sense and to make more people understand mm-hmm. what's there. And if you just keep spreadsheet after spreadsheet, you know, but people can make that come alive in a really, really special way. So
mm-hmm. not to mention to have people who just say, hey, maybe don't design a machine that steals art. Like, maybe.
Yeah, what if they did that?
That would be weird. I don't think anyone would ever do something like that.
Who would do something so morally repugnant? Oops.
This is what happens when you have scientists who don't read books, who don't consume fiction. It's like, we could have warned you. We did warn you.
Or they're reading
about all the things.
I just like to say, I don't think it's scientists that are making.
Well, that's valid too. No,
it's
that's true. It's the
I
business.
I think it's tech bros.
Yeah, it's the business majors.
That meme of we finally invented the torture vortex from the book.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't invent the torture vortex.
Yeah.
That's well, true.
And, you know, actually, last year I had a story come out in an MIT Press anthology.
Oh, cool.
And it was called 12 Tomorrows. And it was actually about an AI being used for science to design novel pharmaceutical molecules and to test them against existing molecules in its database and to try to come up with, you know, different combinations and different reagents and different ways to economically and quickly make these molecules. And I was like, you know, if, quote, artificial intelligence, unquote, which we still don't have, but I mean, like, large-scale neural networks and large language models and naturalistic learning models, this is the perfect thing for them to do, because practically the only thing they're good at is large-scale pattern recognition mm-hmm. and coming up with generative patterns based on existing data. So pharmaceuticals is the perfect place to put them to work, not fucking stealing my books.
Yes.
And turning them into glurge.
Yeah.
So what I'm seeing here is that rather than STEM and the humanities going to war against each other, we should ally and go to war against the business majors.
Yes.
I think this is the plan. I think this is the plan.
Well, and speaking of vermin,
oh, good segue.
We are not going to insult perfectly good insects by comparing them to business.
Exactly.
Majors.
That's what I was going to say. We've got to be careful here, cuz it's a slippery slope. But one, I think, so, Premi, when I first, I mean, I knew who you were, I think it was because it was early in 2020-ish when I was doing Thread Talk and I did a whole series on beadwork and I did a part of it on beetle wings. And of course, everyone was like tagging you in it. And I was like, that's cool. And then you actually had a beetle in your little picture. And I was like, someone who also likes bugs and is not squicked out by them, because I am a child who, exactly, yeah. And my fingernails are inspired, none of you can see it, but they're inspired by
they're
iridescent
very, very pretty.
Beetle wings. So I wanted to talk, one of the things I was really excited about coming on as a new person to this group, because I'm one of the new hosts, is I love flora, fauna, all of it. Biology, I get so excited talking about it. I lectured my husband for half an hour yesterday about various bug products. But I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about it, because part of your brand is definitely the love of the insect world, which outweigh us pound for pound in a huge amount of ways, but influence us and are part of our worlds in ways I think most people have no freaking idea. So talk to us a little bit about our friends, the bugs.
First of all, I love the mental image of, so you didn't actually specify this, but the mental image of you actually following your husband around for half an hour as he tries to get away from you, still talking about bugs.
A little bit, maybe.
A little bit.
We were in
He's
the
like,
car.
I'm going to go to the garage. And you're like...
He was trying to go for the handle.
Just trailing after him. Secondly, the word brand, when applied to a human being, makes me want to gag. So I'm going to avoid using that, because I don't think people can be branded, and I think that's a revolting idea, far more revolting than bugs. But I've always really liked bugs generally, which is hilarious to my parents, who have flat out told me that part of the reason they emigrated from Guyana, South America, to Canada was that they had been informed that the giant tropical bugs that plagued them down there did not live up here. The fact that we have things like wolves and bears was kind of a minor issue, but they didn't learn about that till later. But they think it's very, very funny to actually like bugs instead of immediately hitting them with a rubber mallet as soon as you see them. To be fair, the bugs that they are dealing with are not the bugs that I have grown up dealing with. So just as an example, a little anecdote. When I was 16, so the summer between finishing high school and starting university, my mom and I went to Guyana, my parents' home country. My brother did not want to come, which, okay, legit. I wanted to come. I was very, very curious. Mom hadn't been back for years. I had never been. And practically the first thing that happened was we got out of the cab. We went to we walked up the gate to my uncle's house, and Mom gently pulled my hand away from the gate. And she said, just give it a second. And I was like, okay, do they have like an electrical, do we need to like buzz in or something? She's like, no. It turned out she had seen a shadow on the far side that looked kind of familiar. And it was one of those like 13-inch tropical centipedes that eats bats and mice and frogs. That's how big they are. And they have a very recognizable silhouette and way of moving. So Mom had spotted that. So if I had reached for the gate latch, it would have bit me. So I kind of, after a while we, opened the gate and Mom was like, there it goes. And I was like, which is not going to communicate well on the podcast, yeah. But
it was a good face.
It was a good face.
We assure you.
I feel like the vibe is going to come through.
I do too. Yeah.
Because we all know what that look is.
Just absolute. I see why you guys left. I would have actually swum to North America if I had to grow up with these things. So for the rest of the 3.5 weeks that we were there, every day there was some goddamn thing that I pointed at it, and I was like, is that normal? Or is that like a mutant size of one of those? And there's Mom in the back of the house. No, that's fine. Don't touch it.
That's actually a baby.
Yeah.
Something like that.
They get bigger.
3.5 weeks. Very educational. Extremely educational trip. So they find it very, very funny that I like bugs. But again, I like bugs in more kind of the aesthetic and mental and theoretical sense. I don't actually want one of those 13-inch bat-wing centipedes dangling from my ceiling. I like bugs in the way that they need to not touch me, generally.
That's valid.
But, I think they're beautiful. They're interesting. They're complicated. They can do so many things that we can't do. They can spin silk, and they can frickin' fly and walk on the ceiling and walk on water and live completely underwater and dance to communicate. Okay, to be fair, some of us do dance to communicate, but like better than us and live in, amazing societies and grow their own food in fungal gardens underground. And if people, I think, generally kind of thought about the interesting lives and lifestyles that bugs lead as little animals trying to live their lives, I think maybe there would be a lot less hate. So I guess growing up, I was just constantly shocked and saddened by how much hate there was. And the reason that I have the beetle avatar on social media has nothing to do with liking bugs. It was because I was doing an experiment with acrylic inks, like homemade acrylic inks. On these little canvases that I bought, and I thought that one looked cute, so I just put it up temporarily. And then, like a day later, somebody pinged me on Twitter and was like, "Are you a real bug?" I'm like, part of me doesn't know how to answer that. Like, are you okay? Anyways, yes. And then I just decided to run with it because I thought it was funny.
I mean, when someone hands you something like that, I feel like, yeah, just lean into it and see where it goes.
Just lean into it.
Like, how far can I go convincing this person that
I am in fact a bug? And I have Wi-Fi. And I probably have a phone.
But your name is not Gregor Samsa, so.
Yeah, but my name is not Gregor Samsa. Yeah.
Yeah, but, like, it could happen to more than one person. If it happened to Gregor, it could happen to anybody. And, you know, in this modern day and age, you would still have to work remotely, even if you turned into a bug.
Yeah, like, turn your camera on. You're like, I can't turn my camera on this morning. Why not?
Someone on Blue Sky, like, just 2 days ago, posted a cartoon. It was like, of, like, Gregor Samson found himself turned into a bug, but on his phone, it's like, yeah, we still need you to come in, though. You're scheduled to work.
Yeah, you have to come in for your office day. Sorry. Yeah, and you have to bring snacks, too, actually. And he's like, anyways, That wasn't really like a verbal objection. I keep forgetting that this is going to be audio.
I know, it's fine.
I'm so sorry, you guys. I'm just a train wreck and I forgot to eat lunch, so I've got like low blood sugar.
Well, by all means, get a snack if you need to. We can always, you know.
No,
I'm going to edit that out. Okay, exactly.
I'll eat after this. I'm so excited to talk bugs and worlds.
Well, exactly. And you were talking about why people in general should think more about bugs and respect bugs more. But why should writers specifically and world builders specifically, why should we think about bugs more? What should we think about bugs more?
Because they're such an important part of the world. I mean,
an important part of the world. Yeah.
There's that great quote. It's because somebody, this was back in like 19th century Britain. They asked some famous biologist, like, the question is like, what have you learned about the nature of God based on your studies? And he said that if there is a God, he is inordinately fond of beetles, for he has made so many.
Which is a really cute thing to think about a God, just being like, I'm just going to make
This one's going to be
purple. This one's going to be green.
I assume you guys have read Terry Pratchett's The Last Continent.
Yes.
Yeah, where there is actually a God who's just, every time he's stressed out, he just makes another beetle and just like, and you know, the legs start going like this and he just turns it loose and he's like, okay, I feel better. What were we talking about? So I always loved that. When I encountered that in that book, I was so delighted. I was like, this is why there are so many beetles.
But I think it's a great...
Because it's like cross-stitch. Like,
but I think that's one of the things that like people generally just kind of, first of all, lump insects and bugs into one big thing as if you could possibly encompass the incredibly diverse worlds of small animals that are arthropods and all those things into one place. But also like people don't know that there's hundreds of kinds of bees and like, you know, people spraying their bees, the mason bees and things like that. And not understanding how
my heart,
I know how essential they are to our environment. And you're right. I think this whole concept of the least of us, you know, understanding, okay, a bee might sting you, but like that's their last defense. And in some cases, literally their last defense, they're going to die.
Most cases
after that, because,
and it's the same as wasps and it's the same as ants. And if people haven't read, The Sting of the Wild by Justin Schmidt, you know, it talks a lot about the evolution of the sting and how the vast, vast, vast majority of everything that you think stings you cannot sting you. Because it's only really, you know, the eusocial insects that have defenseless young to protect. Most solitary wasps can only sting the prey that they're trying to sting. like their stinger can't even penetrate a human epidermis. It can just penetrate a caterpillar, you know. It's only the ones that have babies, really, that are closely packed together, like in a wasp's nest or a beehive, that have to sting. And it's so evolutionarily expensive, you know, to maintain a stinging system in those venom glands. And, you know, as you mentioned, most bees with the barbed stinger, they actually die. Mm-hmm. And it's, I don't know, it's sad. And I mean, and if people just kind of get down low and think about how cool the, like, the living of some bugs, like how they make their living, you know, did we all not go to the Space Science Center when we were kids and go, what the shit, at the leafcutter ants?
Yes,
how much
yes.
cooler could anything in the world be than leafcutter ants? Or like a bolas spider, you know, we think we're hot shit because we invented bolas, and there's a bolas spider like, I actually made this for my butt. Hop! And like literally just throwing it at an insect and tangling its legs together and then going over and eating it. It's like, oh, we're smart. You know, that kind of thing. But I think people feel, I mean, A, people don't know. So like you say, you know, they're spraying perfectly harmless local bees that we really, really kind of need to pollinate our food, you know, or killing wasps that have never stung them or would notice them to sting them because they're way on the other side of the house or whatever. But I think people also kind of feel a little threatened by things that don't look human enough, that don't just trigger that sort of idea in our lizard brain. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, okay, a puppy, we map onto a baby. Okay, jumping spiders, maybe we map onto them too because they kind of look like puppies. But, you know, a hornet,
yeah,
maybe it doesn't trigger that. It looks kind of threatening. And then the other issue is things that come in swarms or large groups, we freak out. You know, we're not going to freak out at a single fish. We are going to panic if we see a bunch of piranha. We're not going to freak out at a single bee in the house. We're going to freak out if there's like 5,000 bees. Mm-hmm. Anything that swarms is just scary. We feel threatened. And the idea that they might, you know, gang up on us to harm us, or that they might get inside of us. Like, there's a reason in Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, that they don't give Chekhov, you know, a truth-telling pill. Instead, they put the SETI eel into his ear, and everybody screams and freaks out. And that shows us exactly how evil Khan is, and also how bad the planet is, because they have to put up with these things. But anyway.
Well, I'm just thinking that, like, I do think some of those anxieties about the things, that them not being close to human or close to mammalian even, shows up in a lot of fiction. So many monsters of sci-fi have, it's usually either reptiles or insectoid or some combination of the two traits to show us that they are alien and they've developed differently, even though, like, sometimes they're just like a larger scale of things we literally have right now.
Like xenomorphs.
Yeah.
You know, the xenomorphs, they kind of move in a way that we don't find nice or good. They look like a praying mantis. They're kind of hard and shiny, and again, we feel threatened by that. What if we attacked them and that hard, shiny exterior just repels our weapons? You know, oh, it's a big bug. It's a bug. I don't like that. And also, of course, the getting inside you problem. Or, you know, like in The Mummy.
Mm-hmm.
The scarab beetles. Yes. Oh, yeah.
There's a guy, and his only job, presumably, is to raise those flesh-eating scarab beetles so that they have a bucket of them when they need to perform the Hom Dai, the worst curse known to all of mankind. I don't know what his life is like. He must have a very weird life. But anyways, he has to be ready when they need to do it.
He loves it, though. That, like, he's so excited to raise the flesh-eating beetles.
He's like the Bantha Keeper in the Star Wars movies. He's like, my buddy! Yeah,
it's like,
anyways.
It's like, you know, like, I've been waiting. Like, I've been raising these beetles. And there have been no blasphemous, treasonous actions. Finally,
but today,
tried to kill a
so
sparrow.
Happy. Today is the day.
I think about
my
that guy a lot. Yeah.
Well, and I think that's a really good connection, though, too, is that bugs remind a lot of people of their mortality, because we do know that the way that our bodies naturally will go down back to the earth is through their help. I mean, they are the helpers. They are the mini carrion of the natural world. And that's a really scary thought, especially being conscious, right? Like the only bugs that really squick me out are maggots. Like I can pretty much deal with anything, but if I open up the garbage and there's maggots in there, it's like the black spots start coming and something very visceral inside of me is like, nope, that's not something we want near our body because that's bad news. Mm-hmm. And yet now we know that we can use larvae and some kinds to actually heal wounds. Yeah. So
which is probably fine, provided people don't look.
I couldn't look. I couldn't tell me that it was happening.
Like, you can stab me with needles as many times as you want, provided I'm not actually looking at it.
Yeah.
Don't make me look at it. But that leads to, you know, the other thing, which is that we're actually not wrong to be leery of bugs that carry disease, right? Like
mosquitoes.
Black death.
Yeah.
You know, even before we knew about it, you know that your house being full of like silverfish and cockroaches and fleas and ticks and stuff like that, you know, that's, you know.
Okay, ticks
too.
That's
not a good environment for you. You know, that's not a good environment for your children. You know they carry disease. Mm-hmm. You're not even thinking maybe of like agricultural pests and stuff, like the experiments that they were trying to do during World War II of dropping literal agricultural pests onto fields to kill, you know, various types of crops and starve people, which, yeah, again, bugs in warfare. Lovely. Yeah. It's, I don't know. Have you guys read Six-Legged Soldiers by Jeffrey Lockwood?
Mm-mm.
It is a stunningly horrible examination of how insects and insect-adjacent things, like other arthropods, have been used in literal warfare for thousands and thousands of years, and that includes things like plague-infested fleas. Mm-hmm. So, you know, people are probably right in some cases to be a little bit leery of them.
Yeah.
But the fact that that's so, like, universal, and the fact that people spread it out to everything and they treat, you know, a ladybug the same as like a tick, like knock it off. I don't know.
Well, and I think that the swarm thing too, and you talking about warfare made me think of locusts, right? This
a literal plague,
but actually transforming from a garden variety bunch of grasshoppers and something in the environment changes them where they literally change color and size and become this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the sound of it, I watched a special about sort of the Midwest Dust Bowl era and like people saying that like overnight clothes would disappear off people. Like that's the level to which these bugs would destroy everything. So like cataclysmic. And I'm always interested that like there's not as much of that in science fiction and fantasy as you might think. I mean, what a...
Which is really weird.
What a great way to have a villain as someone who's learned how to harness that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah. Like, again, I'm surprised it's not more prevalent. Maybe I'm just reading all the wrong books. Like, you occasionally see, you know, books where, like, oh, ants are the bad guys. Or the movie, you know, like, Them or whatever. Like, nuclear ants are the bad guys. Or Kingdom of the Tarantulas, which was, like, so a friend and I watched this a couple of years ago, you know, got drunk and watched it, and we're like super disappointed because we thought it was going to be giant tarantulas. Instead, all it was like blorbillions of like the smaller ordinary sized guys, which are like 3 inches across. Yeah. And we were like, oh, come on.
The genre does like the giant spider, though.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Yes, it does like the giant spider. Yeah. Yeah. But like, why not the giant anything else?
I'm trying to remember what the insect, if it was a spider, if it was something else in the classic hit. Kong Skull Island.
Oh, I was thinking Honey, I Shrunk the Kids because that was a big ant.
I watched for Tom Hiddleston. Tom Hiddleston being scruffy and delicious is why I watched that movie. But there was some there was some giant insect that like it was so big that like the legs were like tree trunks.
It was a spider. It was almost like a daddy long legs.
Yeah,
and they were looking up and up and up and up and they're like
it speared
where's the body?
Right through a guy and it was But I think like that's
and the guy dropped his water bottle and I was like. That's not good.
And I feel like we've had giant scorpions, too. I feel like scorpions have good PR.
Yeah, yeah.
They're like, they just look cool.
We've definitely had giant scorpions.
They look cool.
Like,
yeah, they're like...
They've got that
Clash of the Titans had their
Yeah, Clash of the Titans! Yeah. Yeah, the Scorpion King movies. Yeah.
Ah, yeah.
With Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
But so much of this... It's interesting. Just, I never thought about it exactly this way, but... The way you're talking about it, so much of it intersects with like body horror and those instinctive fears. Like you're saying in The Mummy, when we see the flesh bulging when the scarabs are under it, it's like, oh my God, that just makes you get all wiggly and crawly. And it appeals to something that is just very primal, I guess, in lots of us, which is why they tend to show up in villainous circumstances or used as weapons when they are there in lots
that
of specs.
That the bugs will invade you or change you. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, The Fly with Jeff Goldblum, like that's
yeah. The other idea too, kind of like, you know, oh, maybe if it's a, I don't know, if it's like a bear or something, or like a wolf, we can maybe understand its behavior and sort of figure out what it's doing. Even if we can't negotiate, they seem comprehensible. But the swarm, there's nothing we can do. We can't talk to them, we can't bargain, we can't coerce, we can't kill them, there's too many of them. You know, our autonomy as a character is gone.
Mm-hmm.
And the insects are the ones with agency. And that's really scary to us. It upends our idea of where we're supposed to fit in the great pyramid of being, mm-hmm. which, despite us being, you know, relatively enlightened creatures in 2024, I think a lot of us still subscribe to in some way. It's like, I'm higher up for sure, absolutely, you know, than that silverfish. And silverfish like, oh, you know, I donated to 3 charities this week.
Even in the modern era, it's like the one part of nature that we can't seem to tame or stop.
Yeah. And I love that idea. Like, you should see that in more speculative fiction. We can't tame it. We can't stop it. It's a type of magic. It's like wild magic almost.
It totally is.
Or it's like breaking the laws of physics. This nest of wasps is sure going to do whatever the hell it wants.
Although I've got to also give props to the people, because, and so many folks don't know how many places we're eating, using, taking advantage of bugs in our daily lives. Everything from the shellac that goes on the fruits that we eat, to the carmine in the lipstick that we wear, to the perfumes that we have are because of bugs in the world. And it's just so funny when...
And like the beetle beating.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We've been doing this forever.
Why don't we see more of that too in sci-fi? Like, you know, more bugs as like feedstock or like decoration, or, you know, I've used them in my books as, you know, fairly frequently, you know, communication devices. Mm-hmm. What could be better for a communication device than something like a genetically modified dung beetle, like in the Void series? Mm-hmm. Admittedly, Johnny's kind of lost control of them, so they're just kind of wandering around the house, rolling anything behind them that's vaguely round.
Aww.
And if you see one going by, you try to, like, give it something round. So there's a scene where, you know, Nick, the narrator, is like, oh, for God's sake, and he crumples up a receipt that he's got in his pocket and gives it to the beetle, so it walks off rolling it behind it. You know, I've got... You know, I wrote a little story for Audible last year called The Ants of Bimbleby Hill, you know, where the ants are helpers and kind of doing something that ants actually do at things like, you know, paleontological sites or archaeological digs, which is they turn up the soil and push things that are heavier up to the surface, like twigs, like rocks, like artifacts,
you know,
jewelry, potsherds, things like that. It's actually considered good to have a nest of ants at your dig.
And I know that there are some insects rather that are used for like cleaning bones and things like that too. They do a better job stripping.
Yeah, and they're very delicate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're little mouths.
It's better than harsh chemicals to do the job.
They're little nibblies. Yeah. And yeah, like in The Siege of Burning Grass, I just went like totally berserk. And I read a review or something the other day that said it was a biomechanical setting, and I was like, that's a cool phrase. I didn't know that was what I was doing, but I started off, you know, it started really kind of from the little tiny conceit at the start of the book, which is instead of using hypodermic needles, this nameless insane doctor has just genetically modified or something, I don't know, genetic something, this weirdo has modified wasps to be like giant, you know, 3 or 4 inches long, and to produce different things in their venom. So like there's an anesthetic wasp, there's an antibiotic wasp, there's the wasp that has the growth serum that's growing back our main character's leg, which is why the book opens up by saying they locked him up while his leg grew back. That's the first line of the book. But you know, after that I was like, well, why wouldn't you just use a needle? Well, wasps are more interesting, and this tells you that you're headed into a world that's kind of weird. Mm-hmm. So they also have things like shot lizards, these lizards that produce, like, ammunition. You know, they have light spiders. They have bioluminescent spiders, and you put them in an enclosure, and if you flick it, the spiders turn on. Very fancy people have lighters that are, like, a type of, like, glowworm. and you go flick, and it produces a little flame and it lights your cigarette. If you are not so fancy, you have one where you go flick, 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 and it may not light and it might bite you. You know, if you... And that was very fun to work on throughout the series. You know, bugs doing jobs. Bugs, employed bugs.
Yeah.
Or other animals and things like that.
Well, and it is so plausible. That, I mean, I think we forget that evolution is in a sense of a form of technology. It's just the technology of nature that has created. I mean, we know that there are cousins too, but there are shrimp who have so much force per snap. It's one of the strong, yeah, the punching shrimp, more than almost
Manta
anything.
Manta shrimp.
Almost anything in that we've even created as human beings. Like nature did that over millions and millions of years, and we're like, oh, but you eat shrimp. It's like, well, you okay? Yeah,
well, yeah. We're not eating this one.
But isn't there just one kind of shrimp? No, there's so many kinds of shrimp, you know, and bioluminescence is always one of my favorite things because it's everywhere. We just have so much light pollution in the world that we don't see what you used to see. But when we go to the coast here, one of my favorite things is to go for night boat rides. And there's so much in the water and in the tidal pools that is like alive and it's like Christmas lights. I mean, they're like nature does this for us. We just don't pay attention.
If we really sat down and thought about what a kind of like... evolutionary biochemical miracle a firefly is, I think we just like lie down and not get up, but nobody ever thinks about it. Okay, I think about it, and I do a lot of lying down and not getting up, but then I eventually get up because deadlines. But you know, it is weird, I guess, to me that I am including bugs as a deliberate part of my world building and as something that interacts with the characters instead of kind of being like background or wallpaper, I guess, because it, like, you know, like Marshall said, it's very, very fair and reasonable to point out that, of course, they're an enormous part of the world, but it's up to us, I guess, as the author to say, you know, yeah, do we want to include the bugs because they are interesting, or do we want to include the bugs in our world because they touch the plot, or, you know, they affect the characters? I like to do the latter.
Yeah.
I don't want my bugs to be wallpaper. I mean, I would like bug wallpaper. That's a totally different conversation.
I got some bug wrapping paper today from a friend. It was very, very exciting. So, when you talked about...
But if your wall was just like a wall of beetles that can like move around and form colors and shapes that you wanted...
See, that'd be cool.
That'd be programmable. Beetles. Yeah, that would be phenomenal.
Yeah.
I was thinking too.
Or a programmable beetle dress.
Yeah. Totally. Well, they have, you know, I think there's the other part too of like, for some reason, and I would say in American culture especially, because vermin and according to other people, bugs have been such a, you know, a pest problem. It's also an area where we're allowed to be cruel without much. No one's really going to be mad at you. I mean, I will be mad at you, and I get very upset when people in my family kill the bugs instead of putting them outside. But I remember in Girl Scouts, it was one of the first times I'd ever seen fireflies, and we were camping together. Of course, I was like 11, and I was out there catching them to look at them. And I come back into our tent, and the other girls had killed them and smeared the glow on their arms and faces. And I had this just moment of... am I so different? Like, how could you take something so beautiful?
They were sociopaths.
But at the time, they were like, this is...
I was about to say.
There were like, parents there, too.
Did they grow up to become tech bros?
You know, I think there was just, like, it's just considered okay. To me, it was just this, like, destruction of something so beautiful. But it's like no one was mad at them. That's what you do. You look, it's cool to glow.
They're like, that's what kids do. Yeah.
But it's not. And I think that that's kind of a sad place, but it's a good place in a sense from a narrative perspective to build more of a story around. We do have a responsibility as the purportedly more ethical, self-aware species, right? Quote unquote. That thinking about that, I mean, almost every religion in the world has similar parables to considering the smallest among us and what that means, including entire religions where you can't hurt anything. Like the whole point is not
like the giants or whatever.
Yeah.
And you even think too of like the way that it's constantly kind of like repeated and reinforced and repeated and reinforced, extremely minor things, you know, like video games. Yeah. Oh, what's the one thing you can kill without using up too many ammo points or whatever? Is insects, is bugs. Mm-hmm. You know, what are the bad guys that you have to defeat a zillion of because they don't really matter? It's bugs. You know, a bug's never going to be the boss. They're never going to be on the boss level. I feel kind of sad about that, except in like Starship Troopers or whatever.
I was going to say the brain bug.
But you know, yeah, it's something where they are, where we don't think of them as animals. We just sort of think of them as like stuff, mm-hmm. almost like moving dirt. Except, you know, if you see something like a cockroach or whatever, you're like, there's a big piece of moving dirt. I'm going to kill that and not think twice. Admittedly, if I did see a cockroach in the house, it's probably getting killed rather than just ejected outside because I'm going to be like, it's going to come back in. Or this guy might eat it, which is disgusting. Although the other day, a pill bug got in the house, like world's unluckiest pill bug. And the cat, as far as I can tell from when I last saw him to when I actually rescued it and threw it outside, he was tormenting it for like 45 minutes.
So, man. Yeah, I mean, and that.
And it didn't die. Like, it was just balled up like, oh my God, what is happening?
That's a cool defense mechanism, though. I wish I had that one.
It is a very cool defense mechanism, yeah.
I think I would be a roly-poly if I was a bug. Just curl up in a little ball. Leave me alone.
Cool one. Yeah. Leave me alone. Don't touch me.
Or dragonflies. Dragonflies and damselflies are some of the friggin' coolest things. So cool. I garden here, and my favorite time is the later summer when it's just, they're everywhere. And we're in North Carolina, so they get big out here, you know. They are monsters. And then of course when they're mating and you get the double one, they're just like flying together. You're like, that's how to do it. Cool. That's how to make it memorable. It's like a flying carpet ride. It's very Aladdin, but with although I don't think Aladdin and Jasmine were quite that close when they were flying around, but it's a Disney movie. You get that's, my idea.
We didn't see their honeymoon. We didn't see their honeymoon.
The worst part about this is that the magic carpet is like sentient in that scenario. It's so true. It's like, anyways.
He seems down with it though. I mean, it has to be consensual because he could just bop him right off. So
right.
Yeah, but now he's like watching you on your honeymoon,
and he's into it
in the air.
Yeah.
It's like, is this technically a threesome? Is this, I don't know. Anyways.
You're both all over its skin.
In my next thesis, I will.
Who can we get on as a guest to talk about sentient objects as world building? Things that should not be watching you.
That are watching
you.
I'm sure there's somebody out there.
There probably is somebody out there. A surrealist or somebody.
Anyway, biology.
But we've talked a little, we tend to do this where we talk through the questions because we're just kind of natural. Creating new species. You talked about the, like, obviously the injectable wasps, right? Which is a super cool concept. Have you, when you're creating something brand new, what are some of the features that you particularly love to imbue them with or added extras?
Added extras, the value add on weird bugs or creations, I don't know. A lot of it kind of is thinking about the constraints of the world. So if I've made a, I don't know, like a fantasy world, then I would like to come up with a plausible way that these bugs are affected by magic. Or, you know, can they use magic? Are they intrinsically magic? Can they store magic? Or was magic simply used to create them? Does it wear off? You know, it's kind of like the, you know, what N.K. Jemisin kind of talks about is the factor X mm-hmm. in your world. And if you've made a world that is not Earth, but it's just Earth-like, then you've got a factor X that makes that world different. So it should permeate everything in your world building. So I try to think of that. And, you know, for instance, for Siege, it was the idea that people are capable of just altering animals to do whatever they need to. And honestly, in the back of my mind, I was also kind of thinking like the Flintstones, you know, where he's got like that little tiny pterodactyl or whatever that's like the record player, and you just bend it down and its beak goes on the record and it just spins around. And it's like, why have I got a regular boring record player when I could have something that's alive? So that was the other kind of philosophy for this was, what can you have that's alive? And then the other considerations of, well, okay, now that we've got this, what makes it a limit or a constraint on the plot? Mm-hmm. How can this be something that affects what the characters decide to do next. How can this be something that shuts doorways? So for instance, in Siege, you've got these medical wasps that go with him. They're still insects. They're very fragile. If you get into a fight and the cage is destroyed, they could be very easily killed. Mm-hmm. You have to feed them. You have to make sure they have water. He's got a little container of their special food. You have to, you know, you've got all these considerations, and all these things are like limits on the freedom of the characters. And I think that's so important, no matter what else we're doing with the world. When you create that new species, you have to make sure it's not like a perfect, magical, hand-wavy thing that's just like a can of WD-40 on the plot. You never want it to make life easier for anybody. The ideal is it makes life much, much harder for the people that we care about so that they can work around it or work together to overcome it, or you know, get underneath it or kill it or something. We want it to be an active part of the story. So it has to have weaknesses, it has to have flaws, but it also has to have inconveniences. Mm-hmm. So I guess that's kind of where I start with that. Or like, you know, I had a short story a number of years ago, The Honeymakers, which, as you can guess, involved bees. And the bees are kind of the avatar, messenger, you know, kind of a part of the local god of the forest. So they have a job. And of course, bees also have all these limitations. You know, they need flowers. They need water. You can't communicate with them. You can't force them to do anything they don't want to do. They will just leave.
Sounds like my children.
And then you won't have any honey. And you may have possibly pissed off a god. So, you know, they're almost like, they're not really like an ally. They're like an unknown, mm-hmm. that you don't know if they're like helping you or if they're an antagonist, or, you know, they're another character that you can't communicate with. And as soon as you've got that in a story, the urge is to be like, well, I can, just give me some time. But it's a constraint. It means that the story goes a certain way.
The thought that just popped into my head is the idea of magical pests. Not that they are necessarily created of magic, but that they are attracted to magic. Because, you know, like, so many insects work on, like, magnetic fields, you know, like, how they find their way and communicate. It's like, what if there were insects that were attracted to the use of magic? So, like, the wizard in his tower is just constantly like, oh my god, they're everywhere, I can't get my work done.
That's awesome.
Or like a wizard's trying
like
to
like a moth just like bopping around.
Exactly.
On the
yeah. like attracted to a light. Yeah.
Or like a wizard who's like trying to hide, but the bugs are giving him away. Like, it's like, yeah. He's in that cave, like, you can tell because of all the bugs.
Yeah, he's in that cave. There seems to be like a huge amount of spiders there. You hear like the wizard inside screaming.
And he's arachnophobic at the same time.
And he's arachnophobic because of course he is. We can't write the story if he likes spiders.
Yeah.
So
they have to be annoying him or frightening him.
They have to be annoying him. Or, you know, as he was growing up, he was like, well, I sure hope I'm not magical like my parents. And it turns out that he is. And it turns out that the insect that he attracts, arthropod, that he attracts is spiders, whereas they both got butterflies or something. And he's like, why couldn't I have gotten? Like, butterflies are
spiders.
Nice. They're pretty.
Why did it have to be spiders?
Why did it have to be spiders? Exactly. And yeah, you know, you want to consider the world itself, too. You know, if everything's set in the tropics, you know, go wild. Mm-hmm. If I've got people walking through a desert, I've got a much more limited palette of things that I can, like, develop. Okay, well, sandworms. But you know what I mean? You know, that a desert bug of necessity is not going to look like a tropical bug. Mm-hmm. And it's going to live a different lifestyle and everything. You know, like those silver ants in the desert or whatever. They're not going to be like those leaf cutter ants. There's no leaves for them to cut. So lots to consider.
Or the amazing really? Camouflage, too. I think we're lucky we've got an amazing bug house over here in our Museum of Life and Science. And they've got the orchid bugs. I forget what they're called, but they're the ones that look like orchids, and the stick bugs and the leaf ones that have
and like those giant leaf katydids.
Oh my gosh.
And yeah, you're looking in there and it's like, there are 5 katydids in this exhibit, and you're like, the fuck there are.
And to think about that in a fantasy setting, like how many things something could learn to camouflage upon to,
like in Kong Skull Island.
We're going to go back there again. I could not get through it.
I was thinking of the movie Mimic, where it's the cockroaches who not only are giant, but learn to look like a guy in a coat.
Yeah.
Or like in Men in Black, where they just put on the Edgar suit and it's actually like a bunch of different bugs.
Or you could just go the China Mieville route, which is just have a lady.
Yeah, which is just have
just the head of the bug. On.
It's just the head of the bug.
I was never, remember reading that pretty early in my 20s and just being like, my brain just did not want to. Let me imagine what I was. It was so hard for it was so well done, but it really did just like it was like a record scratch for my brain to be like, now?
It's like, sorry, but they're also, but they're like going out. And it's like, yeah. They're,
she's like a hot naked chick.
Like a hot naked chick, but also, yeah, they're like their boyfriend and girlfriend.
And her head is a bug.
She also has, her head is actually a bug. Yeah.
It's a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot to take in.
And he doesn't explain it. And there's no, I cannot think of an evolutionary reason that that could happen.
Reason for
but
that?
It's fine. It's fine. It's
well, I mean, same with everything else in his books. So yeah.
It's just a giant bug that evolutionarily has learned to mimic looking like a hot naked lady.
Exactly.
It's not actually a hot
like, naked the body actually isn't a body. It's actually one of the legs that's been modified.
You know, very
like
possible.
Ant mimic spiders or like the ant mimic beetles or like actually everything he mimics. Ants. But anyways, if you see something that looks like an ant, it may not be an ant. That kind of thing.
Like the velvet ants that we have here, which are beautiful, but...
Which are actually wasps.
They are, exactly. And horrible. Do not touch. Do not touch. But I follow it around with my camera and I take pictures because they're so cool. They really do look like velvet.
Well, they're cute and fuzzy. They're also the number one, I think, on the Schmidt pain scale. Still number one. I don't think they've ever been knocked off. The other thing that I did when I was in Guyana was I hung out briefly with one of my cousins on my dad's side. He's actually not a cousin because he wasn't from an uncle. Anyways, everybody in the Caribbean is related. But he was doing his master's degree on bullet ants. And they don't call them bullet ants because they look like a bullet. They call them that because when they sting you, it's like you're being shot. Wow. And the other thing they call those guys are cow killers.
Yep.
Not because the sting kills a cow. But because when they sting a cow, the cow starts running, usually steps into a bullet ant hole, breaks its leg, and then you have to kill it. And the reason that they're becoming a problem is because as people clear the rainforest, the bullet ants start moving out into like the rangelands and savannas where people are trying to pasture cows that aren't supposed to be living there because they didn't evolve there. And the bullet ants are like, I don't know what that thing is, but I hate it, and I'm going to sting it.
Which I mean valid, like.
Which valid? There's my cousin, he's like, I literally, you know, I can't argue. And they're like an inch long too. Like they're very, very big ants.
But that's basically something else I was thinking about when it comes to like biology in our world building. And not just bugs, but all kinds of biology, is that like it speaks so much to the health of your world, of your environment. Are the plants and animals that are there the ones that are there naturally that evolved there? Or are they invasive species? Or has it been, you know, have we had desertification when that should not have been a thing? It didn't happen naturally. And the ways that that can also be, you know, that can be part of your plot, whether it's fantasy or science fiction.
And it begs the question, too. It's like, are we human characters? Are we the invasive species?
Are we the problem? Are we the problem? I think we're the
problem. Is the bug's range staying still and we are just moving in? So you, of course, get into these ideas of, you know, colonialism and anti-colonialism. Absolutely. Are we going somewhere we don't belong? And then declaring that everything there belongs to us and we have dominion over it. And now it is just a resource to be used up. Whereas, again, the bullet ants are like, actually, we disagree with all of that and we're going to sting you.
Yeah.
Again. Legit, if I was a bullet ant, I would be stinging people like all day
absolutely
long.
or
like, that would be my hobby. Yeah.
To be able to, like, if you're thinking
like, I would stream it on pay-per-view, like, look at me, I stung 15 people today, woo. Yeah.
I think you'd be a good bug influencer. Yeah,
I was gonna say,
tune into my Twitch stream. It's me twitching.
Yeah.
Sorry.
So what?
anyways, lots to consider.
What you've already mentioned a couple of books, but I would love to hear from you, since we don't often have scientists, practicing or non-practicing, upon the podcast. What are some
a defrocked scientist?
It's okay.
That's a great term.
I'm a defrocked medievalist myself, so non-practicing medievalist, you know. But once you're there, it never really leaves you.
Defrocked Shakespearean scholar.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So, but what are some books that you've found that are helpful in kind of opening up your eyes to that our listeners might find interesting?
Oh my God. I think I've already mentioned a couple of my faves. I loved Amy Stewart's Wicked Bugs.
Ooh.
I don't know if you guys have read Amy Stewart books. She also writes sort of like historical mysteries. Ooh. And stuff. And I think she's written a book about the poisons, specifically in Agatha Christie books.
Ooh.
I haven't read that one yet, but I bought it because I loved the premise. But Wicked Bugs is about the bugs that have like inconvenienced us in some way, you know, and some are the, you know, just nuisances, so she kind of classifies them under nuisance, and then some of them are like, you know, legitimately dangerous, like rat fleas, you know, that carry like typhoid fever and stuff like that. And it's just, it's very, you know, it's written in a very lively and interesting style. I super recommend that.
The full title is just
book.
For a second, because this is the coolest title ever.
Yeah, sorry.
Wicked Bugs, the louse that conquered Napoleon's army and other diabolical insects.
Love it.
That was probably typhus.
I mean,
yeah.
Wow.
It's Love very, it. Very good. I super recommend it. I also really liked Edible, and I don't remember what like the tag phrase was for that one, but by Daniela Martin, which talks about sort of the historical versus like the current ways that you can use bugs for food, which, you know, as North Americans, as Westerners, we don't usually think about, except when we're eating, you know, things where we can't not think about it, like shrimp, because shrimp is bugs. But like, you know, or if you're taking apart a lobster, you're like, I'm trying not to think that this is a bug, but a lobster is a bug.
Mm-hmm.
Come on. A lobster is a bug. A crab is a bug. They're all very tasty. But like, you know, this talks about things, you know, that are more traditionally buggy bugs.
Mm-hmm.
And stuff like that. And I really liked that because it shifts your perspective a little bit. It helps you think about things a little bit differently. Sting of the Wild, I think I already mm-hmm. mentioned, which is so good. Six-Legged Soldiers, which is just disgusting. So interesting. And The Wasp That Brainwashed the Caterpillar by Matt Simon. I loved that one. And it's, you know, of course it isn't just about bugs, but it also talks a lot about, you know, parasitism
mm-hmm.
generally, and how you're supposed to live in a world with so many parasites. So many parasites.
And did we get rid of them all to the point that we're working against us now? It was one of the most recent thoughts of some science, that our bodies evolved alongside of some parasites that we no longer have. And now we have things like horrendous allergies that we didn't have to suffer from before, because people used to have worms that helped maintain that.
Yeah.
Cass is
I would also
right
recommend
now.
Parasite Rex by Carl. I'm sorry. It's either Carl Zimmerman or Carl Zimmer, but it's called Parasite Rex, which is also fascinating yet horrible reading, like a lot of science. But I recommend all of those. But yeah, I don't know. For further reading, I can go on. I have like 45 books about
awesome.
Books. I can't think of them all off the top of my head, but
that's all right. That's a good start for our listeners, those who are bug inclined or would like to become bug inclined.
Perhaps they would like to become bug inclined.
I mean, there's always room for more bugs, whether you want to or not.
I mean, over on the Discord, we had a whole conversation about vulture bees, and that spawned a whole.
Awesome.
Vulture bees are carnivorous bees.
Marshall.
Yes.
And they make meat honey.
Yep.
They take yeah. little bits of meat and cure it in the honey. They basically make jerky.
It's bacon. It's honey bacon.
Yeah.
It's honey cured bacon, which is and like hipster food.
Come on. Isn't that amazing? Yeah.
It is amazing. Yes. I am amazed.
Well, I was talking also Oh, go ahead.
Apparently, the scientists don't really know how they make honey, because they don't do anything with flowers at all. It's just like, where does the honey come from?
Well, I mean,
is it only bee spit?
Is it?
Anyways.
And they only eat meat. So is it meat?
Bees are great.
Yeah. I mean, Bees are great.
Well, and it's, well, I was, Premi and I were talking earlier about ambrosia beetles, which because my current hyper-focus is perfumery, which is like the cousin to fashion because it's got so many overlaps and stuff. But learning about oud wood, which is one of the most expensive things in the world. It's not just so basically there is an immune response in the tree, in the agarwood tree, but it is triggered by these beetles, which have a parasitic relationship with a certain kind of fungus. And all of these things happen to have this wood create this incredible resin that smells like, literally they call it like the god wood. It smells so good and it's so expensive. And it's just amazing to think about all these little levels that you had to get. And if it wasn't for the beetles, and if it wasn't for the fungus, and if it wasn't for the tree, half of our perfumes wouldn't smell the way that they smell. And people have, you know, lived and died to find this stuff. And it's all because of bugs. You know, just an ambrosia beetle.
I'm picturing the beetle like, we're helping.
I know. We smell so good. But what a cool, cool thing to be able to, like, you'd never, ever, and that's such a world-building thing that sounds like, in the conversation I was having with my husband, I'm like, these sound like fantasy stories, but they're not.
It sounds like a fantasy story. Well, even when you think about things like, you know, the way that you have to pollinate tomatoes in a greenhouse, like you have to do it by hand or you have to get people to literally truck in bumblebees because only bumblebees can buzz at the frequency that releases the pollen that allows them to go and pollinate the next flower. So if you don't have a local population of at least a couple of bumblebees, you're never going to get tomatoes on your plants. So there are places that will actually have, you know, you either have to go with a frickin' paintbrush and a vibrator or you have people who have to come in with bumblebees the same way they do for domestic honeybees. It's just, and again, telling people that you do this like as a job or whatever at a party, I don't know. I don't get invited to parties.
You can come to any of my parties. I don't have a lot of them.
I just want to point out, my parents did it with an electric toothbrush. Yeah. So you.
There you go.
And bumblebees are amazing.
Because you have to do something.
Yeah.
Just saying
you have to do something.
You have options.
You have options. I don't know. Insects are really cool. I don't know.
Bumblebees are just floating little teddy bears.
They are floating teddy bears.
I know. I love them so. My kids are always amazed when I'm out in my garden and they're like, but there's bees. And I was like, they're going to sting you. I'm like, no.
Yeah, but they're
not.
But they're bumblebees.
They're busy doing bee stuff. They're sweat bees and bumblebees and mason bees and honeybees. They're way more interested in the bee balm than me. The only time I ever got stung by a bee was because I was trying to clean up some of my plants and I bent over and trapped him in my folds and he stung me because but you know, it was fine. It was sad, but that's the only time in years and years. Oh. But we seem to think that like they're out there waiting to attack.
They're waiting
us.
To sting. Just, no.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
That is like my experience of yellow jackets. Every time I've gotten stung, I was minding my
own
business.
They are kind of
the assholes of
they are the assholes of bee world.
Yeah. I was telling an anecdote actually on something the other day, and it was like one of the times that I got stung, actually on the same trip where we were doing a specific type of assessment, a migratory bird assessment / rare animal assessment. So we were up at the site for a couple days. So we had already had a bear encounter. So I was already like, can we just go? So my poor supervisor like, no, we can't. Yeah. So I was standing at the edge of a clearing, holding my clipboard and talking to my supervisor, and watched as a tiny yellow dot flew, zigzagged across the clearing, flew out of the trees, flew towards me, landed on my wrist and stung me. And I was like, what did I do? I thought if you don't bother them, they won't bother you. And my supervisor's like, I'll go get the cortisone cream. Like, what has happened? What did you do? Like, to this yellow jacket specifically? Yeah, it's like, I had a contract. Okay, well, who put out the hit on me? Like, God.
It's like biting flies. To me, those are biting flies and mosquitoes. I grew up in New England and
hate those guys.
Black flies, deer flies, and horse flies. They will, they're relentless. And I swell up like crazy. And same thing with mosquito bites. People are like, oh my God, what bit you? I'm like, it's a mosquito. They're like, no, it's like that. No, it's a mosquito. I know. But you're all swollen.
Yep,
yes,
same here.
I know. Apparently,
it puffs up a lot.
One of the theories is that it has to do with your blood type, that it can see certain people with certain blood types have a bigger reaction, and they can see it better because it has more infrared visibility, huh. I think is one of the theories.
Thanks, I hate it. But
yay, great for me.
It. You're just tastier.
Yeah.
I do like the idea of assassin wasps that could be contracted. Yeah, like, like that's a good story element. Like even if it's not to tell you, it's like it's not even like assassin, but it's like yeah, like I'm not. I'm mad at you. I don't
want
to.
But I do want
you,
a wasp to sting you.
But
yeah.
I want you to suffer a little.
Like, I really want it to, like, pop up really bad and itch for like 2 weeks.
Seeping.
Yeah, that's what I want.
Send you a message.
Yeah. Like, I paid the wasp with like a little slice of lunch meat. Like, you know, 2x2 inch slice of lunch meat. That's what I paid. Yeah, bastard.
Like, that guy.
Go get
that
him.
Guy right
she's
there.
Like,
go get him.
On it. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, there really are so many great world building choices you can make.
Look how many story ideas we've just come up with.
But we are pretty much, we've blown past our hour, which is,
I am so sorry.
No, no,
it
no, no,
happens.
No. Nope. It's, yeah.
No, it's happening constantly lately. I'm not sure we've had an hour episode in like 3 years.
And they knew I talked a lot before they asked me on this podcast, so.
The great thing about podcasts is nobody actually like holds you to a time slot or anything like that. But as is our habit when we have a wonderful, brilliant guest, is we invite you to add some sort of world building element to the world we've been building online here for 5 years or so, and give some little gifts to incorporate into the world.
Oh my God! Okay, so I regret that I'm going to have to say this. So I was going to come up with something really nice about dung beetle navigators, because they actually use the stars to navigate, the stars and the moon. And so on cloudy nights, they're just rolling themselves in circles. But, you know, so I thought maybe I could add that to the world, is that people have, you know, dung beetles maybe that they carry around with them and that they use as a compass because they're magicked in some way. Instead, I found a ridiculously horrible one.
Yay!
So there's a parasitic wasp called Copidosoma floridanum, which lays 2 eggs inside the cabbage looper moth. This is actually good news for cabbage farmers, right? But I digress. So once it's done that, the female egg changes its division style. And instead of becoming one wasp, it turns into clones, up to 1,200 clones. Of these, 200 of them become soldiers inside the caterpillar, visibly different from their siblings, with different mandibles and a pointy part at their back, and their only job is to kill other wasp larvae. So the siblings develop and grow and drink the caterpillar blood while the soldiers fend off any competitors that have tried to target the same, like, just horribly unfortunate caterpillar. Then the other siblings emerge and fly away, and the soldiers die in the body of the caterpillar because they're kind of disposable. So now, in our world, we have created wasps that act as murderous killer guardians, but only attacking whoever we tell them to. And they'll also attack anyone else who gets too close and smells wrong. But they recognize their own and will protect them, like, to the point of death.
Wow.
At any expense, at any account. So these are the most loyal guardians that anyone has ever had.
I love it.
Love it so much.
Absolutely see that, yes, developing in our wild little world.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Cass is so freaked out right now.
The more you read about parasitic wasps, the less you want to, like, continue living in this world. I'm not even joking.
For some days, I feel like I welcome it, though.
And this has been the case since, like, the 1800s.
I, for one, welcome our parasitic wasp overlords.
People learning about parasitic wasps were like, I have lost my faith in God forever. I not only am going to stop being a scientist now, but I am never going to church again, because how could a benevolent God have created not only parasitic wasps, but so many parasitic wasps? So if you look up, like, the history of the study of parasitic wasps, there's all these, like, despondent letters from people in, like, the 1850s being like, I cannot go on. I just found out about parasitic wasps.
It's amazing.
I've lost my faith.
Yeah. But it's intelligent design, right? Come on, guys.
But like, in the Discworld tradition, you've got your god making cute beetles, and then you've got a really pissed off god making all of these parasitic wasps.
Yep.
Piss that one off. Yikes. Well, this has been horrifying, but also delightful.
absolutely magical.
Thank you guys so much for inviting me. This was so fun.
It was an absolute blast.
Hi, you. Thanks for listening to this episode of World Building for Masochists and letting us help you overcomplicate your writing life. If you want to know more about your hosts and the fantastical books we write, links to all of that information is on our website at worldbuildingformasochists.podbeam.com. We also have an archive of all of our episodes and links to more information about the guests of every episode. We really hope you like this episode. If you did, please do take a minute to tell a friend, shout about us on the internet, or leave a review on iTunes. If you've got questions or just want to tell us how cute we are, there's a number of ways to contact us. We're on Twitter, Blue Sky, and Threads as @WorldBuildCast, and our email is worldbuildcast@gmail.com. We also have a Discord chat room linked in the About the Show page of our website if you want to come chat with us and other fans of the podcast. We'd love for you to share the worlds you're making and help us all build until it hurts.